Welcome back to the Beer Truth Podcast. My name is Tom, and today we got another big one. Vinny Chalurzo, Russian River. I mean, that's pretty awesome. You definitely know Russian River for Pliny the Elder, Pliny the Younger, probably Blind Pig, but there's STS, Consecration, Supplication, all the Shun beers. There's too many to go over in this intro. So you're going to hear Vinny's story. There might be more to it than you thought, but I'll leave all that to him to tell. If you've been to the old Santa Rosa pub, you know it's a pretty cool place. Lots of stuff going on, vintage brewery on it and all that. And I'm not going to lie, they make the best chicken wings that I've ever had. And they're not even fried. Pizza's really good too. And it's just a totally different vibe than the big new Windsor beer factory. Still great food, just a very different menu and a very different aesthetic to everything. At the Windsor location, you can find some unique beers. As I mentioned later on in this conversation, they have a little pilot system there. There's also a big, huge outdoor space for sitting in the sun and spacing out and enjoying a beer and all that stuff. It's really a world-class operation all the way around, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to Daniel Lowe at Russian River, formerly at Stone, for being awesome and always hospitable. And you didn't tune in to hear me talking, so let's get on with it. Vinny Chalurzo. So yeah, let's just start with where it all started for you and the original meaning of Blind Pig before the beer and go from there.
Sounds good, yeah. So I got my start. I was actually in the wine industry when I was a kid. So I grew up in the vineyards, but not up here in Sonoma County where we're at now. I was down in Southern California in a town called Temecula. Temecula is kind of almost equidistant from like Orange County, San Diego County, a little bit farther away from LA County. But anyways, mm-hmm. my parents had a winery there, vineyards, and they actually planted the first vineyard there in 1968, so even before I was born.
Okay.
So I was born into the grape wine growing business, and you know, eventually years later when I left to go to college, I moved in with a couple of buddies, and we started home brewing, and I was in 1989, so my hobby kind of got out of control, if you will, with the whole home brewing thing. And that was in 89, but by 1994 I had had the bug to start my own brewery. So I found a business partner that could run the business side, and we went out and found an investor, and he funded what became Blind Pig Brewery, and this was down in Temecula. Mm-hmm. So Blind Pig is a old prohibition term that can also be the same meaning as like a speakeasy. You know, someone be like, well, I'm going to go to a Blind Pig. The term had multiple meanings. One was that folks would pay a small fee during prohibition to go in and then see a Blind Pig, and with that they got a shot or, you know, drink of alcohol or whatnot. Yet another meaning that we came across was that a pig was a mason jar, and an unmarked mason jar was a blind pig that they would serve beer in. And yet another story was that they would give the pig the moonshine, and if it went blind, then don't drink it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how true that one is, but I'm not even sure how true any of these these stories are. But anyways, that's the meaning of the term Blind Pig. So that's what we named the brewery. And, you know, we made double IPAs, IPAs, and then a golden ale and a barley wine. And that was, but, you know, we were most known for our IPA, even though we were making more golden ale. I mean, keep in mind, this was 1994.
Right.
There was only a handful of IPAs being made in America, and even less West Coast IPA, which is what we were doing there. So I did that for a few years. And in late 96, I decided to sell my part in Blind Pig. I was working some pretty long hours, and I could kind of see the writing on the wall that it was going to be several years before the business was profitable. And my body was already deteriorating from the long hours. So I sold my part of Blind Pig, and Natalie and I moved to Northern California, to Sonoma County, where she you know, continued in the wine industry. And I was able to find a job at Corbell Champagne Cellars, who was opening Russian River Brewing Company. Mm-hmm. So that was in 97 that we did that. And I believe we brewed our first beer out at Korbel under the Russian River name in April or May of 97. And so we just made some really great beer out there. It was a beautiful facility, awesome company to work for. But by 2002, Gary Heck, the owner of Korbel, decided he wanted to get out of the beer business. He'd really been kind of downsizing a lot of his non-wine, sparkling wine businesses, and the brewery was one of them. So by 2003, we had left Korbel. But you know, one of the cool things that happened there was I traded them my severance package for the Russian River name. So that's how Natalie and I were able to carry the Russian River name forward and keep it going and have that transition from when we were located out at Korbel to our Santa Rosa, our downtown Santa Rosa location. So we opened in 2004. By 2008, we opened a production brewery, and that was in South Santa Rosa. And then, you know, a few years after that, we started buying out all of our investors, and eventually were able to buy all of them out, buy the property that we built our Windsor brewery at, which is where we're sitting now. Mm-hmm. And so that was in 2018. I guess we brewed our first first beer here in okay. Windsor, and you know, we still have the Santa Rosa facility going. We still brew there, you know, make 3,500, 4,000 barrels a year there. So okay. nothing to sneeze at. We make a lot of beer at that location.
Is that still the original system that you had there?
It's not. No, okay. The equipment that was out at Korbel, I actually helped Korbel sell. That was a 15 barrel system, and it was a sweet little system, but it was just a little bit smaller than what I wanted. I was really looking for a 20 or a 30 barrel system to put into Santa Rosa, because I knew aside from having beer being sold over the bar for on-premise and growlers to go, I knew we were going to be distributing out of the back door, and we just needed a little more volume.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question about the Blind Pig, and because and you kind of explained it all. I didn't realize there was that connection, because there's a bar in San Francisco called the Tipsy Pig. There's in Vermont, there's the Prohibition Pig. There's the Thirsty Pig in Portland. Yeah. And so I didn't realize. I was going to ask. I didn't know you had the background on.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of bars in the Midwest called the Blind Pig. And so protecting the trademark's a little difficult. We do own the trademark, but it's one of those terms that goes back long before, you know, we ever used it. So and there was a Blind Pig in Temecula, and I knew about it because I wrote a report about Prohibition and how it related to Temecula when I was in high school, and I come across Blind Pig, and that was one of the memories. It was like, I remember that from high school when I wrote that paper on Prohibition.
Okay. So, there's a lot of connections there that don't always seem to, you know, maybe seem random sometimes, but there's a lot more to them.
Yeah, for sure.
So what really made you, even back in Temecula, go with inaugural ale and Blind Pig and start to push, kind of set the groundwork for, you know, Pliny the Elder and the Younger, and really pushing the boundaries? You know, barley wines can be very hoppy.
Yeah.
What made you start pushing those boundaries? Was it just homebrewers and you like to experiment?
Yeah, you know, as a homebrewer, I instantly started making IPAs. I bet within my first 5 or 6 beers, my roommates and I were making IPA.
Okay.
Probably not that good, but you know, and I think that's the case with most homebrewers. Most homebrewers don't start out making great beer.
Yeah, I'm still there.
You know, honed in the skill, and I loved American hops. I liked the idea of it. When I was homebrewing, there was basically one West Coast IPA, Rubicon IPA, which unfortunately they're closed now, but they're in Sacramento. And that was really an IPA that was an inspiration for me. You know, it just had, and it was classic hops, Cascade, Chinook, Centennial. You know, when you think about those early days for us, for like Rubicon. There was another West Coast IPA, Swami's, that Pizza Port made in Solana Beach. That was another early one. But, you know, for all of us that were making West Coast IPA back then, it wasn't even called West Coast IPA, you know, there weren't hardly any hop varieties available. I mean, that's one of the things that I like to remind people is that, you know, even when I started homebrewing in 89, I remember wandering into the homebrew shop in El Cajon, California, so East San Diego, and picking up a bag of what was the first experimental hop I ever saw, and it was called CFJ90, and then there was another one next to it called CFJ4. Still have never figured out whatever happened to CFJ4, but CFJ90 turned into Centennial. So, you know, Centennial we take for granted now is like it's always been around, but in the late 80s, it hadn't been released yet. Columbus, which is now so ubiquitous, and it's what's used to make most hop extract in America, that hop had just been released in the early 90s as well, and was really hard to get. So when we started, you know, making IPAs at Blind Pig in 94, some of these hops weren't even available, and they were really hard to get, and they took some time to be able to get a steady stream of them. So so like the first Blind Pig IPA recipe had Centennial in it, but didn't have Columbus. Columbus had been released, but there wasn't a lot of it in the ground.
You just couldn't get it.
Just couldn't get it. Yeah. But I loved the flavor contribution that it gave.
Do you have a beer, or at one point did you have a beer named CFJ90?
It's a one-off canned beer that we did during the pandemic during 2020.
Okay,
yeah, and so CFJ90 was an all Centennial hazy Centennial beer. Again, the idea in that beer was just to kind of buck the trend of all these new designer hops and using an old school variety like Centennial in a hazy IPA.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I figured it was some experimental hop. I didn't realize that that's what became Centennial.
Yeah, that's what became of
Centennial.
You got
me on that one too.
So, So I just liked that flavor profile. You know, I homebrewed a lot with making IPA, and then when it came time to open the brewery, I knew that we couldn't survive at Blind Pig just only doing IPAs, especially at that level. I mean, it was more bitter than any IPA we do now. It was 90 BUs measured, measured in a lab. So we made a golden ale as well, and I didn't want to make a pale ale because when you think about it at the time, you know, who was the predominant ale producer, you know, was Sierra Nevada. You know, and I love Sierra Nevada. I've always have huge respect for them. But I didn't want to compete with them with a pale ale. So that's why I opted to do a golden ale, figuring it as, you know, industrial lager drinkers were working their way up. They would move up to a golden ale. And then from there, maybe they would move to a pale ale and then hopefully an IPA. And they would eventually drink our IPA.
Right. Yeah, that's... kind of the you saying not wanting to compete with the pale ale. It's something that Rob was talking about at Allagash with why he moved to Portland and why he didn't stay in Vermont to open the brewery, because back then he was like, well, there's like three or four breweries in Vermont, and it was, you know, 20 miles away would have been direct competition,
right?
Instead of as it is now, I think there's like five breweries within half a block of Allagash.
You're on industrial drive there.
So you're often credited with basically creating double IPA and kind of making that a style, and now, like I said, it's, you know, been pushed to triple and quadruple and
quintuple
barley wines, whatever that means. what is your opinion as someone who's been doing this for a while on these other new extremes, like the lactose IPA and peanut butter fluff in stouts with coconut and macaroons and sours with gummy worms?
I honestly have a soft spot for just traditional old school, you know, beer, traditional styles. You know, not to say that we don't push the boundaries, especially with, you know, sour, funky beer, you know, where we are using different fruits. But even that's pretty traditional in Belgium. You know, and I love styles, you know, like Belgian white beer, where, you know, but again, that's traditional. So, you know, it's not to say that we can't make our own traditions, But I do personally feel like there is probably some, you know, component of brewing now that's maybe taken a little extreme. I mean, let's take, for example, a cereal beer, and someone's throwing in, you know, fill in the blank cereal.
Yeah.
And on the surface, it's like, all right, well, okay, I guess that's cool if you're, you know, going to throw in, you know, chocolate Count Dracula, you know, cereal. But then, you know, read the ingredient panel of those ingredients, and it's like, I don't want that crap in my beer.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, if you're making a Nilla wafer beer and you make your own Nilla wafers, then great, you know what's going into it. But you buy that box of Nilla wafers or, you know, cereal, there's a lot of crap in those in cereals that quite honestly may not even be legal by the TTB to put in your beer. You know, even so, this is getting a little bit into the weeds, but if in California, at least, if you are only selling your beer in the state, you technically don't need to get a federal label approval. You only need to submit it to the state. A brand registration. So you don't even have to submit the label. But if you're a brewery, even if you're making a beer that's only being sold in the state, if you're using non-traditional ingredients, you still legally have to do a statement of process with the TTB, which is disclosing all of the, if it's a non-traditional ingredient. You know, if you're making a beer with, you know, yeast, malt, hops, and water, you don't have to do anything. If you're, you know, with the registration, with the TTB, but if you're adding odd ingredients, they have a list of ingredients that are acceptable. Some of those trigger the statement of process, and I'm pretty sure a lot of the ingredients in some of these, you know, crazy ingredients that are going into cereal beers and cookie beers and stuff probably aren't legal with the TTB. But for me personally, it's more of I'm not sure I want to, you know, have those things in the beer and not be truthful to my customer. You know, hey, there's actually some weird, you know, preservative that's in this cereal. You know, there's a reason why, you know, these cereals can sit on the shelf for months on end because they're packed full of stuff to preserve them. So I think I take a view against them more just from that standpoint, not because it's not creating something new and unique, because that's the cool thing about the craft beer industry is that, you know, everyone can create something unique and different. But at the same time, you know, let's not forget about food safety and the regulations that we do need to follow, because, you know, the more the breweries push the boundaries, the more the FDA is going to start sniffing around breweries, and we're going to start getting regulated even more. I mean, another perfect example is the pH of 4.6. That's pretty well accepted in the food industry that anything above 4.6 is now a food safety issue, and the FDA, that's where they draw the line. There's plenty of IPAs out there that are over 4.6 because dry hopping causes the pH to rise. And so, you know, that's something that I personally want to see the industry be more focused on, because I don't want the, you know, we're already regulated enough. And so we're going to get even more regulated the more, you know, the FDA and other government agencies are sniffing around, and because it does become a food safety issue in their eyes, whether it is or not.
Yeah. And I've never thought about that as the ingredients that are in the cereal that are ultimately ending up in the mash, and then, because there's quite a long ingredient list, and you don't see those ingredients listed on the beer when it's like, you know, we dry hopped with Lucky Charms, and it's like, well, there's that, to your point, that means a lot more than just marshmallows and little, you know, processed grain cereal going into the beer.
Yeah.
There's a lot more in there than,
exactly,
than just that.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what I mean about the like taking it and go with the conversation, because that's two good points that I've never thought about.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I like to make fun of the slushy sour stuff.
Right. Yeah,
and
but
there's more to it than just the surface of, I think this tastes like crap.
Right.
And I had a can of some slushy sour thing the other day with my brother because it came in Sam Adams and Hop Culture did a queer beer fest,
okay,
virtual yeah. festival, right. And I was like, well, I don't want to drink most of these beers, but it's a good cause and it's right. affordable enough, and so I ended up dumping most of it, but I was like, I don't know why these flavors are all in the same thing, and the second half of the can was chunky and the first half of the can was watery, and
right,
and it's like, keep cold at all times or else, they don't say it, but the can's gonna
possibly explode. Yeah, that shouldn't be on the consumer.
Yeah,
the breweries need to, the breweries really, the onus is on the brewery, not the consumer.
Yeah,
and I hear the brewers say, oh well, well, what about milk? What about fish? It's like, yeah, that's true, but at the same time, the practice in America is that beer, doesn't have to be kept cold, even though we all know it should be. Even, Budweiser, Miller Coors, any of those industrial beers should be kept cold. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you're putting something into a can or bottle and there's a safety issue and you knowingly know that, you're also setting yourself up as a business owner, for failure and
yeah.
potential litigation and that sort of thing. So, yeah, the barrier to entry into the beer industry is pretty easy. You can get a homebrew system and use it and you can make anything you want, and that's great. But at the same time, breweries, if someone wants to get in the beer industry, they should be serious enough and have a focus on safety, because safety is always, that's the most important thing, no matter what you do. And in the brewery, safety, it comes down to whether it's consumer right. safety, employee safety, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Something I think doesn't always get talked about is just that side of things. Like you can start a new brewery and, drop $1 million or get bank loans and get the shiny new system. But there's breweries that have, all that going for them, but then make beer that is maybe not good or is being recalled because of just not paying attention to detail or
yeah.
some stuff goes wrong. Once in a while it doesn't meet your standards. I know you guys just didn't release a batch, some single hop beer.
Yeah,
not too long ago.
Yeah, we had a batch of Siegel Select, which was a beer we make every once in a while, and we didn't release it, but made it again. And we've interestingly have a batch of Mind Circus right now, which is our hazy IPA that didn't ferment. And as it turns out, it looks like the dry yeast was the culprit, because we used a different yeast for it, mm-hmm. and it's just simpler to use a dry yeast because you can have it around. And it didn't quite finish fermenting, so that batch we'll be able to blend it away into a bigger batch in the future of Mind Circus. But yeah, I remember years ago doing a presentation for the California Craft Brewers Association, and it was on quality, and it was basically walking the attendees through our quality program and different pieces of equipment. And, at the end, I challenged the audience, would you dump a batch of beer? Every brewer says they will, mm-hmm. but when it comes right down to it,
yeah.
Will you actually dump it? And most say they will, but most won't. Now, if you're big enough, you have the opportunity to blend stuff away so long as it's not contaminated. And lots of breweries do that. But when something truly doesn't work, and goes south, you do need to be ready to dump it. And
yeah, there's a difference between just not meeting your standards
yeah.
and being a beer that's contaminated that shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And which we've probably all tasted that
yeah.
somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what was the Siegel Select? It just didn't meet your
standards? Yeah, it just had some quality things that we weren't happy with, and we just opted to rebrew it, and You know, that it happens. It's, yeah. You know, and it's, you know, you can, like even with the sour funky beer program, you know, I've always said, and I remember Peter Bukart has always said this, like, if you're not willing to dump beer, dump barrels, you know, you're probably being a little too liberal, because you're really at the mercy of Mother Nature with spontaneous beer, which way, you know, the bacteria and wild yeast might go. And so, yeah, we're always, I was just emptying barrels this morning. I emptied 40 consecration barrels, and luckily they were all in great shape. But, you know, there are times when we have to, you know, I'm tasting every barrel as we empty it, and we have to dump a barrel because it's acetic, you know, the balsamic vinegar. Mm-hmm. And that's why we taste every barrel. And just, you know, and we just pull the hose out of the strainer and just put it down the drain. Our wastewater system hates it, but it's, you know, in a percentage of, you know, even 2% of the total blend was acetic, it would show through, you know, and that's a direct quality, you know, parameter there, you know. And over the years, we've invested in our lab too. I mean, to the point where, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in our lab. And, you know, I wish more folks in the industry would be committed to lab programs. It doesn't have to be to the extent that, you know, we've taken it, but I mean, just now finally breweries are in the mindset that you pretty much should own the dissolved oxygen meter. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the case, you know, and I'll admit we didn't have one when we started either. But yeah, once you start packaging, like, you really should have a DO meter to really be focused on dissolved oxygen. But there's so many other small things that, you know, I think brewers should be focused on when it comes to quality. But it costs money, you know, quality yeah. costs money, and a brewery needs to be willing to invest in these pieces of equipment, knowing that, you know, this investing in a piece of lab equipment doesn't make you money. It's not like buying a tank, you know, where you buy a tank and let's say it holds 15 barrels, you know, and you figure out that, oh, I'm going to make IPA in that tank, you know, on a 21 day cycle, and well, I can turn that tank 17 or 18 times in a year, and you can do the math. Whereas, you know, investing in a lab equipment or lab program, it doesn't make you money, but it saves your reputation, is how I look at it. You know, if you have something that you can catch ahead of time before it goes out into the market, then you've just saved your reputation, and we've kept our reputation at that, you know, ultra high level.
Yeah, I was thinking you can, basically what you just said, you can buy a DO meter or you can buy a new fermenter.
Yeah.
And one's going to bring in more money, and
they're about
not.
The same price. A yeah. good DO meter is $25,000. But there's also alternative. I did another CCBA talk recently with Taylor, our lead lab and who runs our lab. And, you know, her and I made the point that, like, there are some, you know, lower price DO meters. Maybe they're not quite as accurate, but that's how we started. Like, we're on our third iteration of a DO meter now. Now it's the same one we have across the board at both breweries. But when we started, we didn't have the super expensive one. We got the one we could afford, yeah. And then worked our way up.
Yeah. Well, I think being Pliny the Elder and the Younger that everyone know, I think it's kind of an industry joke about homebrewing Pliny and trying to clone it.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever tried to get you to drink their Pliny clone?
Yeah, I've tasted many.
Okay, I figured
I've tasted many. I haven't had one that tasted just like it. Probably the closest one I ever tasted wasn't actually an 8% Pliny, or maybe it was my favorite, but it was called Pliny Light, and the famous home brewer, rest in peace, is Mike McDowell, mm-hmm. or Tasty as he went by. He made this beer called Pliny Light. You know, everyone knows him for his Janet's Brown Ale homebrew recipe, but he did this Pliny Light recipe that was always really tasty. But yeah, I've tasted dozens of okay. Pliny homebrews, and, you know, and I've never republished the recipe per se, or maybe I did once, but, you know, Pliny has had small iteration changes over the years. The type of malt has changed. Maybe the specialty malt has changed a little bit. And, you know, but at the end of the day, it's still the foundational of that, the foundation of that beer is Simcoe and then Amarillo hops, you know, and those are still the two key hops in there that contribute most of the flavor. But we then fill around those hops with other varieties to just get a little bit of pop here and there, a little bit of something. But, you know, it still has Cascade and Centennial in it. And but it has several other varieties in it as well now, just as we've adjusted the recipe and massaged it. And, you know, I think that's why I used to be more hesitant to discuss the changes that we've made in the recipe, but now I've kind of accepted it, and I now my mindset is that what's kept Pliny relevant is the fact that we haven't just kept it the same, because as the consumers have craved more hops, we've adjusted the recipe in that direction to, you know, we've added more hops, it's a bigger dry hop load than it was, you know, 20 years ago when we first made it.
I was going to ask how much your recipes, as long as you've been doing it, how much those recipes have changed over time, as obviously, I mean, going back to the styles and the crazy adjuncts now,
yeah,
you know, preferences change and what's new and what's next. But how much, I mean, is it like you said, year to year, like, you know, crops change and, you know, products change, maybe you get more efficient malts or different things like that?
We learn, you know, too. We become better brewers and we, you know, learn from research that maybe UC Davis or Oregon State has done, which are, you know, two of the premier, you know, research schools when it comes to brewing. Or, you know, maybe we've, you know, the kiln temperature changes on hops, and so that gives us some flavors one way or the other. You know, a good example, I like the hop crystal, and it's bred from some German European cultivars, but it has a little bit of Cascade bred into it, and, you know, from the right farm and the right conditions, you actually get some really nice grapefruit notes from it. And but this last year, all of our crystal that we had on contract had smoke taint from that specific farm,
right,
because of all the fire. So we rejected it. Well, that meant that we didn't have any crystal, and a lot of other crystal from that region in Oregon also had smoke taint. So we had to adjust the recipe, because there's a little bit of crystal in both Blind Pig and Pliny now, and it has been for several years now. So it was easier for us to adjust that down with all the other hop varieties that are in the beer, and it doesn't show to the consumer that we made this adjustment because it's just one hop in there. Now, if all the Simcoe in the world, you know, had some issue one year, mm-hmm, then we would have some real problems.
Yeah.
But there's so much of it grown that we would be able to find it somewhere. So yeah, that's one of the things that we look at when we're, you know, looking at a recipe and looking at small adjustments. But they're small adjustments. They're not huge adjustments we make every year, whether it's because of some agricultural condition or whether it's because, you know, we just think that it will make a better beer. But I think making these small changes has kept Pliny relevant, and it hasn't just stayed at a 1 pound per barrel dry hop, which is what it was, I think, when we started making it. I don't remember exactly, but that's probably about what it was. And now we're at 2 pounds per barrel. But even 2 pounds per barrel is pretty pedestrian compared to some breweries these days that are at, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 pounds or even more per barrel on their IPA.
Yeah.
But I was just drinking a bottle of Pliny last night at home that was just a few days old. But man, I mean, it's got a bigger hop aroma now, and it's cleaner flavors, and everything about it is more focused than it ever has been. And a lot of that's because we have a quality program. We've got this really nice equipment here, and you know, say what you want, but nice equipment does tend to make, you know, more shelf flavor stable beers, and we're always looking at flavor and shelf stability too, even though our beers sell really fast.
I was going to ask about the system here and all that you're doing, but that just made me think, there's a reason that Sierra Nevada is not still using repurposed dairy tanks anymore because they could, you know, move up and get nicer equipment instead of stuff that you got to fix twice a day.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and you know, you could see, you mentioned Rob Todd earlier. I know Rob welded most of his early equipment, and you know, same thing there. They've got a beautiful Browcon, you know, system, and you know, we've got our Zeeman system, and you know, you've got like Firestone and Bell's, you know, using GEA. And, you know, I mean, yeah, there's a reason why we moved to like the German brew houses that are fully automated, that give you consistency there, that just overall have better flavor stability, you know. And that was a goal when we built this brewery, the Windsor facility. It was like, okay, one, have a more safe working environment for the brewing team, have a, you know, higher quality beer, have a great facility for our employees, have a better customer experience for our guests, whether it's in our restaurants or the gift shop or the self-guided or guided tour, whatever it is, like everything needs to be better, you know. And of course, you know, we say like, well, the beer has to be better. It's like, well, it better be for as much money as we, you know, spent on this place.
Yeah.
But it was instant. I mean, you know, within the first batch, second batch, I could be like, yeah, Pliny's better. And we saw it in shelf stability too, and flavor stability as well.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's the ultimate goal, aside from having a more safe work environment for our brewing team. Beyond that, it's like, let's make better beer.
Was the first beer that you made here, was that the porter?
Yeah, what we call Windsor Porter. So okay. It was a little riff off of our Russian River Porter, just like a little stronger version of it.
Okay. Yeah. I remember I had a bottle of that, and I was like, I should probably hang on to at least the empty bottle.
The empty, yeah. Yeah, I still have one. Yeah. You know.
Well, you have obviously the big system. That's, you know, kind of everything centers around being able to produce more and, like you said, better. But you also have the smaller system, which is, am I right in that's a 5-barrel?
It is, yeah.
Okay. And I know the last time I was here, I saw you back there just, you know, middle of the day. I think you were cleaning. But is that like an R&D system, or is it like we want to be able to have fun and do, you know, the last time I was here, I think there was a Hefeweizen.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's not what I expect from Russian River, but that variability is, you know, it's refreshing to see other things. Like, yeah, I could drink Pliny every single time, but being able to have that, and I thought that was a tasty beer. And just, so I guess, is that a fun thing for you?
Yeah, it's both. It's twofold. Okay. It's both what you just said. One, it is just to brew new stuff, have fun, develop new recipes, but we actually, you know, do R&D in there as well, whether it's different malts, new hop varieties, different processes. You know, one of the biggest issues in the beer industry right now, which relates to quality, potential quality issue, is hop creep. You know, hop creep is a phenomenon where the enzymes in hops cause a secondary fermentation after dry hopping, and it's because those enzymes will break down the residual sugar, the long chain sugars, which are typically at body and mouthfeel. Well, the enzymes in the hops break down the long chain sugars, which now your yeast that's left in the beer starts re-fermenting it. And it can be a safety issue because, you know, your bottles and cans or kegs could be overpressurized if not kept in check. And it becomes a flavor issue because you've just created more diacetyl. So if you don't wait for that diacetyl to clear, that's the buttery butterscotch flavor, then that can end up in your final product. Well, so like we're using the R&D, the pilot brewery, to do some testing to try to come up with some ways to better mitigate hop creep. And so we've done stuff in there. We've trialed stuff in there, which now we're actually trialing on the big system right now, because it worked in there, and we'll test it in there. And you know, the new recipes, sometimes the new recipes are actual for something that may become something. For instance, we just sold out a Mosaic Stack, That started out as an R&D IPA, so that beer was on tap. It went over so well that we created this brand, Mosaic Stack, and it's almost all Mosaic with a little bit of Simcoe added in. I say it's legal to add Simcoe into a Mosaic beer because Mosaic is Simcoe's daughter, so they're related. So there's a case where we not only built a brand, but it was really popular. I mean, Mosaic Stack was probably, other than Pliny for President and DDH Pliny, that's been the most popular IPA that we've put out in the last year, and it's definitely on the schedule to make it again. We're getting more requests for that than any other beer right now, so it's cool to see that something started small. Another thing we're going to use the pilot brewery, the R&D brewery, for is once things settle down with COVID, bring teams in from our staff, our brewers, and as well as non-brewers, and putting recipes together and letting them brew in there. And I'll take the lead since I'm the one that runs the pilot brewery on a day-to-day basis, but let them build recipes, put beers out on in the restaurant on the chalkboard that will be, R&D pale ale, and then, description is, whatever the team is that put it together, however we're going to market it, I'm not exactly sure. Mm-hmm. But just give our staff the opportunity to be creative and write recipes, and, our non-brewing staff can work with our brewing staff to get a feel for what it's like to be a brewer and what it's like to write a recipe. So I'm really looking forward to that. I also use it to make a lot of base barrel beers. Probably 3/4 of the beers that have come through there, I've just moved right into barrels. But sometimes I'll do both. Sometimes I'll do like the Weizen, the Hefeweizen, and that one I did do a couple of wine barrels, and then the remaining beer I just force carbonated and put it on tap, and it was fun. I love like that style, and but it's not something you'd normally get from Russian River.
Right.
We're even designing that corner is open in there, and there's going to be a little open top fermenter in there eventually as well to kind of mimic the big ones we have in the brewery here.
Okay. And when you're talking about hop creep, that is another, I think, thing that at least I, and probably a lot of people, associate with Allagash. And because I know Jason Perkins had done, and I'm sure more people, but a presentation on hop creep. And I think that's kind of when at least outside the core industry, people started to understand,
yep,
or at least hear the word.
Yep.
And I know that I know Breakside up in Portland does a lot of work with that, and but just that whole thing is like back to me to the quality and to also to the safety,
yeah,
of your beer, that once you know what it is and you're paying attention, like you're saying, you can work with that and try and take care of it ahead of time so it's not an issue. It doesn't become an issue.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that just made me think of another connection there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I remember when, we were just starting to design the Windsor facility. I remember Jason Perkins from Allagash calling me saying, "Hey, do you ever see, a continued fermentation after you dry hop?" Because he knew we dry hop a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a pretty tight relationship with Allagash. And I said, we're actually seeing it more and more, but we have no idea what it is. We just ride it out. And then the next thing I knew, they were doing research with Oregon State University with Tom Shellhammer at OSU, and that was really the first part of this. But as it turns out, hop creep's not new. It goes back to the, I think it was 1893.
Right.
In England. And I can't remember the researcher's name, but they had a more romantic term for it that they called the freshening power of hops.
That's right.
And if you think about the term dry hopping, it probably, the root dry is from the fact that when they dry hop back in the day, and they had these secondary fermentations, specifically on the long, if it was on the long voyage, around the Cape,
mm-hmm,
making where the name India Pale Ale came from, that probably is what dry meant, was that it dried the beers out, it made it fresher, it made it cleaner. We've always, like, dry beers have always been a cornerstone for us. And, we were talking earlier about, Pliny and change, maybe some small changes, but like one thing that hasn't changed is bitterness. Pliny's always been hoppy, it's been bitter. You know, where more and more breweries have shied away from bitterness these days, you know, that's something to me that I think is a cornerstone of an IPA, whether it's hazy or West Coast or whatever, because that bitterness is really what brings you back, you know, drinking more of it, you know. And although bitterness has dropped, aroma has gone up, which is great. I mean, who doesn't like to just sit there and smell a glass of beer, yeah, whether it's a hazy or a West Coast, and just that amazing, you know, hop aroma, and you know, I love it. And so, you know, looking at something like Hop Creep, half the battle is just knowing that we have to deal with it. And once you know that, then we can start working towards, you know, fixing it, or at least finding some remedies that make it less problematic. Because there is no cure for hop creep right now.
Okay.
So
when is Hazy Pliny coming out?
No, that probably won't happen. I'm happy with the couple of hazies that we do. I'm also happy that it never really took off for us. Like, we didn't have to become a hazy IPA factory. You know, while all these breweries grew with their hazies, Pliny and Blind Pig and Happy Hops just kept chugging along, and we made Mind Circus and we put it out for distribution, and still do a little bit, but we didn't become a hazy IPA brewery, and I'm really happy that Pliny just kind of kept chugging along, and if anything, it went up in production over the last couple of years and even during the pandemic.
Yeah, I was going to ask what the next thing is for Russian River, if that's... Are you guys looking to get into, you just answered the hazy question, but, you know, weird adjuncts and seltzer and cider?
No seltzer from us. Okay. You know, we have some friends in the industry, and we joke that, you know, you can categorize a brewery now into two camps, those that make seltzer and those that don't. And, I'm still baffled by the whole thing, you know, that's legal for us as a brewery to make seltzer, even though there's no malt, there's no hops in it. Obviously, it falls under the brewery license. I've never researched it because I have no interest at all to make a seltzer. You know, I mean, like, when you talk about seltzer, no one ever talks about quality. Because there's no way to talk about quality. It's sugar and yeast and maybe some fruit or something, you know, being added or whatnot. On the fruit side, you can say, okay, well, I'll use fresh fruit instead of extract or concentrate.
Or like Kool-Aid powder.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with using fruit extract. I mean, we use hop extract, mm-hmm. you know, but no, those that doesn't interest me at all. Okay. You know, what interests me moving forward is you know, finding new hop combinations that are great. Maybe we learn something from it that can make Pliny and Blind Pig, our core beers, even better. You know, I love doing sour barrel aged beers. You know, we now have a beer club. It's been fun making blends for that. It's been fun knocking out new, you know, one-off beers in the pilot brewery. I'm just looking forward to making higher quality beer, and you know, hopefully see Belgian beers come back. You know, our Belgian beer lineup has really slowed down, and I would love to see just a good old-fashioned classic saison come back and have a more of a rooted place in the beer world. But right now, you know, consumers, it's all about IPA.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, it is what it is, but it'd be nice to see a little more diversity in the lineup of what consumers want to drink. And I'm sure in time it'll come back, because I'm sure folks will start looking for different flavor profiles that aren't necessarily just hop driven.
Do you see, as hop cravings go up, do you think that's directly why other styles like Belgian styles, saison, I don't know how many saisons I could name that are nationally distributed. Allagash comes to mind, and that
not many, and it's hard to find theirs.
Yeah,
yeah.
Do you see it like a more hops, less everything else?
Yeah, I okay. do. Yeah, and I see. It's just consumer preference right now is hoppy, is IPAs, and like I said, that's fine. But it would be nice to see a little more diversity in what the consumer wants to drink. But like I said, we'll keep chugging away. I love making IPAs. I love the challenge of it. We've been doing it for however many, decades now. And, I've been in on the IPA game, foundationally in the craft beer world. And, it's so much easier to make an IPA now because of the newer hop varieties, Citra, Mosaic. These hops make it easy to make IPA.
Yeah, you're not
because
just
because they're so impactful.
Just cascade at the homebrew shop.
Right, exactly.
For Pliny, is it true that you guys open ferment all your Pliny?
We portions of it is so most okay. most Pliny that is consumed or that goes into package into bottle or keg is probably 20% of it is 20 to 40% of it's open top fermented. So okay. we'll open top ferment some and ferment in a traditional closed top, and then those will get blended together. And then all of our lagers we make, so STS or Velvet Glow, those all are 100% open top fermented. Anything Belgian we make here in Windsor will open top ferment. Okay. I just think for the Belgian yeast, you end up having more kind of levers to pull, if you will, to control ester and phenol aromatic compounds for lagers. I just think it makes a little cleaner fermentation profile, and that's because there's no lid on the tank and they're a 1-to-1 ratio, so they're as wide as they are tall. Okay. So you have a much different fermentation profile compared to what typically a tank's like a 1-to-3 ratio, so 1 times wide, 3 times tall. But when you put a lid on a tank, you're now putting pressure on the fermentation and the yeast, and a lot of times yeast don't like pressure. And a great example is the DuPont Saison strain that homebrewers will always say, like, oh man, like that it never stops ferment, or it doesn't ferment all the way out, it has a lag,
right?
And then eventually it will ferment, but it takes weeks on end. You throw that yeast in an open top fermenter, it'll ferment right through. It's just an example of a yeast that doesn't want to have any static pressure on top of it. But back to your question on Pliny, we find that batches that are either wholly open top fermented or partially just have a softness to them. They have a little bit less of a hard edge to them. And I just like that. And it also is capacity for us. So it's a way for us to use the open top fermenters when we're not making lagers or Belgians and whatnot to okay. use those open top tanks. But in general, it does leave a much softer fermentation profile on the beer. And I wish we could put everything through open tops, but that's just not feasible.
What about the open top directly versus something with a closed top? Are those two wildly different Plinies?
We've done sensory that way before, and in the lab, it's been a while, but in the lab, the open top was almost always preferred.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when we did sensory. So we have done it, but it's been a long time since we've done that sensory.
Okay. You could, your next double dry hop or whatever, do it, just call it open top Pliny and sell out like, the younger. The hop guy, what do you have a favorite hop? Is it Simcoe?
Simcoe's right up there. I have a lot of favorite hops that aren't, you wouldn't think traditionally are. Like, I love Saleya. which is a Slovakian Styrian Golding.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, Salaya is a type of Styrian Golding.
Okay.
I love it in Belgian beers, as you know, in funky beers. It has this really nice orange, kind of orange marmalade quality to it. You find it, you know, in a lot of English beers as well. I love Aramis, which is the main hop in our STS pills. That's a French hop that was bred from Strusselspalt. Has this nice grassy note to it. IPA hops, though, I would say Simcoe. But my other kind of my new favorite hop, and it now has a name. Previous, we were using it as experimental, HBC 692, but Talus. Mm-hmm. And Talus goes into a beer we make called Apical Dominance, and that beer is based around Talus, but it's also got Crystal, a Comet, and a little bit of Citra in it. So, but they're all citrus-driven hops. And Talus itself specifically has this amazing pink grapefruit quality to it, but it's also got a little bit of mint as well. And Talus is the daughter to a hop called Sabro, and those are both Neo-Mexicanus hops, meaning that their origins are probably from here in the States, New Mexico. Neo-Mexicanus is what these are called. And they can be very polarizing, anything that's a Neo-Mexicanus hop. But
I have my opinion on Sabro.
Yeah, Sabro is really, like, over the top. Like, I don't have it contracted anymore, even though we did use it over the years as an experimental. But Talus is something that we'll keep contracted on because it's such a beautiful, wonderful flavor.
Okay. Well, I was told to ask you... what's the deal with hams and all the memorabilia at the old brew pub?
Yeah, so we have lots of old brewery honor beer antiques, and I've always loved that stuff. I love there's one of our accounts down in the East Bay, Ben and Nick's.
And it's in Oakland, right?
It's in Oakland, yeah. Okay. That's sister to Cato's, which is in Oakland, but just in another neighborhood. And I always, like, that was one of my favorite bars when I used to deliver. And I always just marveled at all the old beer antiques.
Okay.
And I was like, when we open a brew pub someday, this is how we're going to decorate it. And so it's not just hams, it's anything, Lucky Lager, but we did have the big ham sign that's at the south end of the bar. I mean, before we had a TV, we joked that was our TV, and you had to sit there and watch the rotating scene go by. But I love the antiques, and there's so much history to that. In fact, yesterday, I unfortunately had another appointment, but Natalie was here with a bunch of the family from the Grace Brother Brewery that used to be the brewery here.
And yeah, I saw that online.
Yeah, she posted it last night, which is pretty cool. And you know, we don't buy too much beer antiques anymore, but I will if I can get my hands on anything Grace Brothers or anything New Albion, those are the two things that I'm always, and probably Lucky Lager too.
Right.
Those are the three that I would still invest in right now if I can find stuff. Like that light that they were holding, that just kind of fell into our laps last year or maybe 2 years ago, and we're going to get it hung in Santa Rosa eventually here.
Nice. We're just about an hour here. I know you have other things to do. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely.
Is there anything that people maybe don't know about you or your story or Russian River that you would want them to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. We're pretty much an open book. There isn't. I don't know that there's too much that folks that are into beer maybe don't know about about Natalie and I and the business. You know, I mean, we're it's pretty evident that we're fiercely independent, and you know, I jokingly say that, you know, we don't have the BA's independent seal on our labels, because if you don't know we're independent, then, you know, that I guess you just don't know enough about Russian River. But it's just something that we are very independent, and you know, are pretty proud that we built this whole thing on cash flow and debt. You know, we bought out all of our investors, and then we, you know, just borrowed money and save money, and that was really, you know, something that Natalie and I are really proud of, that we did this ourselves and we didn't have to take on a brewery partner and didn't have to take on private equity or venture capital or any of those things. And so something that you know, I hope shows and shines through. And you know, and I think just in general, we look forward to getting the place back open normal, you know, getting through the pandemic and get tours back and show people our brewery again someday, and it'll be great.
Yeah, and who knows what, I think today everything is kind of lifted, so we'll see. I think it'll be a month or so before people hear this, but we'll see. We'll see what happens here.
Yeah, for sure. Today's a big day for the state.
All right, there you go. Legend himself, Vinny Chalurzo, godfather of the double IPA. Russian River, amazing beer, amazing food, hospitality. And if you haven't had anything from them before, it's well worth seeking out. But they don't distribute very far, so if you're not on the West Coast, tell somebody to send you some. I think you can also find at least one beer, usually on tap, at the Monk's Cafe in Philadelphia. And I think they might do something in Washington, D.C. on occasion. But otherwise, you got to figure it out. But it is worth it. So, what's next for the show? Well, two of my top five beer legends have been on the show. So, Garrett Oliver coming for you next. Next week, episode with a brewer in a state that we have not heard from yet. But there's only about 40 of those, so you're probably going to guess which one. Other than that, yeah, we're at the part of the show where I humbly beg you to follow the show on social media, subscribe on whatever platform you're listening, all that junk. If you didn't listen to the outro last week, first of all, you suck. And second, I have a Patreon page up and running, so you can give me money now. And by that, I mean help cover the costs that go into making this show. There is internet, domain name, all that stuff. Podcast hosting site, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, anything there is appreciated. That is patreon.com/beertruth. There's several options if you want to support the show, more than just social or subscribing, all that stuff. So you can check that out if that sounds like something you want to do. And obviously it's something you want to do. So yeah, that's it. That's all I have. So go do all of those things and buy some Russian River. And yeah, till the next round. Sláinte.